I'm Bob Kaiser, and this is the course Reading the Mysteries, the Book of Revelation. Today, the second session entitled Lamps and Churches, the first three chapters of Revelation. There is an ambiguity to the title for this course, Reading the Mysteries. On the one hand, the mysteries refer to these obscure symbols and visions and the obscure meaning of the book of Revelation and how it is we can read those mysteries. But it also suggests reading the mysteries of life, the mysteries of the meaning of human history, the mystery of why there is suffering and all the rest. And that's what John was trying to do, of course, read those mysteries for his day. And through John, we're trying to read the mysteries of our 20th century situation and condition to make sense of it as best we can. So the ambiguity is there, and it's intentional. Just a brief word of review, since we have some new people today. Yesterday, what we did was to discuss Revelation as an example of apocalyptic literature. We described this literary form that developed toward the end of the Old Testament and into the period between the writings of the Old Testament and New Testament, as well as the first century of the Christian era. Apocalyptic literature was designed to speak of the meaning of history and to describe the climax of history that people believed God would bring. And it did that, it does that in symbols of an obscure and elaborate kind. And then we tried to suggest some principles of our interpretation of the book of Revelation, and I shan't go through those again, let me share with you the primary one, if I may. And that is that John wrote with a message of hope for his day, along about 95 of the end of the first century of the Christian era. And what we're trying to do in these days is to get some grasp of what John was saying to his original hearers and writers, and then from that, draw some meaning and some significance for the book for our day. And I stress that it's important that we understand, first of all, what John meant for his own day before we try to discern from that what the meaning of the book might be for today. And having done that, we turn now to the book of Revelation itself, and our intent is to skim through it rather quickly this week, I admit. But I ask you to read the first four chapters or so. And I do think it would be it'll be helpful if you have a Bible in front of you. But I didn't mention yesterday that you should bring your Bibles today, so I'm at fault there. But there are a few copies back there. We'll say just a few things about the introduction to the book, and then talk about the letter to the seven churches today. First of all, there is an introduction to the book and its title in the first three verses. And notice that the title of the book is The Revelation of Jesus Christ. John might be very concerned that we speak of it as the revelation of John, because for him it was the revelation not of himself, but the revelation of Christ. And by putting that right at the first, he suggests to us the way in which Christ is central to the whole of what he has to say. And that we'll see as we go on and on in the book. But notice, too, in those first verses, what should we call it? The channel, or channels, plural, by which this message comes down to John. It's given from God to Christ, from Christ to the angel, to the angels to John, and finally now John passes it on to us. And that's important. John wants us to know the source from which his words come. As I said yesterday, it's unusual for an apocalyptic book to have the name, we think at least, the real name of its author. Because usually the writing would be attributed to some person of fame and import in the past. Now the fact that John can say he is the author of this means that He believes the Spirit is active in his day, so that the Spirit is inspiring him today in a way that it inspired Enoch, Daniel, etc. In the old days of the past. These verses are a typical introduction to a prophetic book of the Old Testament. They sound very much like Jeremiah, like First Enoch or Daniel. So John is telling us here, by this kind of introduction, that he's drawing together the threads of the Old Testament and the Jewish faith and Christian faith of the past. He tells us that he's a prophet. Excuse me. And it's important that we understand what he means by that. There is a tendency today to take the word prophet and prophecy in a sense of predicting the future. And that's not quite accurate to the biblical concept of the prophet. Prophet in both Hebrew and in Greek, New Testament Greek, means one who announces, one who proclaims. The Hebrew word Nabi means a speaker, a spokesperson for someone else, of course, for God. And in prophetes in the Greek means one who preaches or announces the message. So John wants us to know that he's a prophet in the line of the great Old Testament prophets, but we must understand that he means by that he is proclaiming a message. It does have something to do with the future, but it's not primarily his function as a predictor of the future that is at issue here, but rather a proclaimer, an announcer of a message. In verse 1, we're told that it's mentioned what must soon take place. Remember yesterday we talked about the sense of determinism in the view of history, what must take place. There is that sense in which this is all laid out, and John is going to understand now how it must take place. The time is near. This is a crucial, critical time for John. He believes that the persecution of the church that's underway at the time is going to get worse and worse and worse, and that Christians must be prepared for that and prepared for what it brings. Okay, after that little introduction, John moves on then in verse 4 to introduce the letter to the seven churches. Anybody want to say anything about that first little superscription, verses 1 through 3? We can't go through all the verses that carefully, obviously, but okay, the letter to the seven churches functions as kind of a cover letter to the apocalypse itself, to this message. And so the letter is a way of kind of making the message specific in certain locales. In other words, John gives this letter to the seven churches to show how the revelation that he's going to give fits in a concrete situation. Otherwise, you know, it's just kind of general and vague, and he wants now for us to see that it's quite historical and quite specific. And at the same time, it's a letter to seven churches, and we all know that seven is the number of completion or wholeness. And hence, by addressing seven churches, he is at the same time saying that this message is for the whole church. Not just for these seven, but because there are seven, that is our hint that he intends this as a message for the whole church. And that introduction then runs from verse 4 to the end of chapter 1. The seven spirits that are mentioned is the fullness of God's Spirit in the church. Seven, again, meaning full or complete. And it's not to suggest the multiplicity of spirits, but the fullness of God's Spirit within the church. Notice in verse 4, the greetings from the Trinity. John has his own form of Trinity. His reference to God as who is, was, and will come suggests God's sovereignty in history. You see, God stretches out from the beginning on into the future so that God is sovereign over all of history. And that's important for John. That's one of the points he's trying to make. That history doesn't just go hither every which direction, but rather God is Lord of history and it has some aim and some purpose. Notice that Christ here is called the faithful witness. And the reason is Christ's witness is suggested here because Christians can emulate, can follow Christ in this way. In other words, what we're told about Christ is something that the believers, the faithful Christians can do as Christ has done it. This is what is relevant, at least for the moment, about what Christ has done. The omnipotence of God is emphasized in verse 8. I won't take time to read it. But one of the things that John must keep on doing throughout the book is to stress the omnipotence, the greatness, the power of God, because Christians are fearful that the power of Rome and the political system is greater even than the power of God. And so he must stress that point over and over and over again. John tells us his commission in verses 9 through 19. He's in exile, apparently because he's experienced tribulation, that he's in trouble somehow with the Romans for his preaching. We don't know how the Romans used exile. That's part of the problem. If we knew how they used exile to punish people, we might be able to guess a little bit more about John's background, but we can't. We must simply take what he knows at face value, what he says at face value, and that to suppose that because of his preaching, he has been sent off to the island of Patmos in exile. It's sort of like being sent to Holden Village or something like that. in absolute isolation. But the important point here is John is telling his readers that he shares with them the suffering of the persecution. He's not standing outside of this and saying, now Christians, you be faithful and suffer for Christ. He is one who himself has suffered, and hence he is affirming this as his solidarity with the people he addresses, the Christians he addresses. John says he's in the spirit when this comes. In the spirit. I suppose we're inclined to take that as an ecstatic experience. That is an experience in which one is carried beyond themselves, outside of themselves, into the Spirit. I don't know if that's what John means or not, whether he means that kind of ecstatic experience that we think of sometimes in the Pentecostal movements, churches, in the charismatic movement, or whether or not he means simply that he was inspired. Inspired in the way that you might be inspired when you write a letter or to your congressman or congressperson, or as your pastor hopefully is inspired when he or she writes their sermon. Is that what he means? We don't know, and I guess it's not really important that we do know. Finally, let me say a word about the vision of the Son of Man in verses 12 through 19, because here now we get the real flavor of John's use of symbolism that we're going to have more and more of. Jesus stands among the seven lamps holding the seven stars. The seven lamps represent the seven churches. That's clear enough. It appears that the lamp is kind of the essence of the church. We Lutherans would say it's where the word is proclaimed and the sacrament is properly administered, you know, the essence of the church. Because later on, he's going to say that what the lamp might be taken from one of the churches if they're not faithful. So presumably it's the essence of the church or something. The seven stars can mean one of two things. And you know, sometimes you may as well know, we're just going to have to say, well, I'm not sure what this means. It can be, once again, a symbol for the churches. And the seven stars represent the seven churches. The fact is that the Romans thought of there being seven planets that the empire ruled. And those seven planets were then, and I shouldn't be holding up 10 fingers when I say seven planets, those seven planets represent the far-reaching authority of the Roman Empire. So it could be that the lamps represent these specific seven churches And the seven stars represent kind of the universal church, you see, the universal planets, and the church in the sense of its universal rule as Rome thinks of its rule. Well, notice the way the Son of Man is described then in verses 13 and following. And these are symbols, most of them, almost exclusively all of them, taken from the Old Testament, Daniel and elsewhere. And each of them, each of these descriptions symbolizes some aspect of or some function of Christ. The robe is like that of a priest, perhaps. The robe and the girdle are garbs of the high priest. The sword is a symbol of the authority to judge, the judging word of Christ, and so on with all of the rest. The hair, wisdom, and eternity, so on and so forth. The most important thing about this vision of Christ is one that we perhaps take for granted, that these are all symbols used of God in the Old Testament. And now here they're used of Christ, which is John's way of saying that for the Christian, you see, Christ functions for God, does what God is expected to do. Finally then, John is commissioned to write what he sees, what is, and what will come to be. In other words, to try to understand and write the meaning of the passage of time, this specific period of history. Anybody want to say anything about those verses or raise any questions? Okay, I better go on quick before some. We come then to the letters to the seven churches, and a couple of things we want to do at great expense and technical expertise. I have produced a map here. They've invited me to become the official mapologist of the village, but I resisted that. Well, you have to use your imaginations a little bit, but that's something like what a map looks like. The point is to try to identify these churches: Greece, Macedonia, the Mediterranean Sea, the Aegean Sea, so on and so forth. This area, Asia Minor, and here are the seven churches. Pergamon, I gotta remember my abbreviations. Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, Laodicea, Ephesus, Smyrna. I like Smyrna. You can tell why. And here, approximately here, is the island of Patmos, where John seems to have been exiled. So these churches are in this area of Asia Minor and relatively close together. And you will also recognize the fact that that's the same area in which Paul lived and wrote and preached. So actually, we're thinking about the churches, some of the same churches, Ephesus for instance, that Paul worked in now, what, about 40 to 45, 50 years later on. Those are the kind of general locations of the churches. The form of the letter, each church is the same. And it might help us to get a view of the forest so we're not lost among the trees. The form in each church is addressed in these four ways. First of all, there is some quality of Christ that is emphasized at the first. For instance, in 2:8, Christ says, "I am the first and the last." That Omega and Alpha and Omega spanning history, that concept and quality of Christ. And such a quality is mentioned, or several qualities in some cases, is mentioned at the beginning of the address to each church. And then the church is praised for its good qualities. For instance, in 2:19, the works of love are applauded. But then the church is censored or blamed for faults. And an example there is 2:4, where they have abandoned the love that you once had. And then, moving from praise to censure, finally, the address to the church is concluded with a promise, promise concerning those who conquer. Those who conquer. And let me tell you now, we'd say a word more about this, that the conquerors, or those who conquer, are the Christian witnesses, the Christian martyrs. John is going to emphasize what it is that the martyr does and the reward that comes to for martyrdom. So that's kind of the general form of the letters. And in each case, something historical about the particular church is mentioned. That is, we can't see this in every case because the allusions are sometimes impossible for us to pick up. But in most cases, each church, something that is said refers to the reality of that church and or its history. For instance, the struggle with the local synagogue in Smyrna is apparently a historic fact, you see, that the letter refers to. In Pergamum, John tells us, is Satan's throne. And Pergamum was the base city for the emperor cult in Asia Minor. In other words, that was to the emperor cult what 2900 Queen Lane is for LCA people, and what is it for ALC? It's in Minneapolis somewhere, isn't it, right? It's kind of the headquarters, as it were. Well, the headquarters in Asia Minor for the movement to worship the emperor and bring that into dominance is in Pergamum. So there's something historical, you see, mentioned at least about many of these. Oh yeah, the other one is that Laodicea was one of the richest cities of Asia Minor and the center for banking. And so the address to that church in 317 is, you say, I am rich, I am prospered, and I need nothing. You see, a reference to the prosperity of that neighborhood, that locale. So stop me any time now you want to speak up or raise a question or whatever. A word more about the conquerors then. Let me read to you what Caird writes about the conquerors. The conquerors, in other words, are the victims of the persecution whose martyr's death is their victory, just as the cross was the victory of Christ. They are the Christians in whom Christ dwells afresh with weapons of love. And we might then at this juncture take a look at what it is that's promised to these martyrs, to these conquerors. At least I found this to be of interest. There is, as I said, to each of the seven churches, a statement, a promise made to those who are conquerors among that church. And these are the promises in 2:8, that they will eat of the tree of life, which obviously has reference to life eternal, life, meaningful life in this world and reaching beyond into the next. Not hurt by the second death means, of course, in the concept of Revelation, the second death is after the resurrection, you see. And these conquerors must die the first death, you see. But John is encouraging them that they will not be touched by the second death. In 2:17, these conquerors are given the hidden manna, the nourishment of God, the spiritual strengthening, and they are given the white stone. There's some debate about what this means. It seems to me the most likely explanation is that sometimes stones were used as admission tickets, entrance tickets. And it appears that this might be what is meant. They're white because white is, in John, most of the time, the symbol of victory and conquest. And the white stones are the admission ticket to perhaps the messianic feast. You know this idea that the Jews had, that when the Messiah came, there'd be a great banquet, messianic banquet, and people, all of the faithful people from the whole world would come to this banquet with the Messiah sitting at the head table. And so perhaps the white stone is the entrance ticket to that kind of messianic banquet. Not quite the same as our Sunday dinner here at Holden, but along those lines, you see. And we won't suggest who sits in the Messiah's place at Holden. That would get risky. Okay, 226. The conquerors will rule over the nations, and that, of course, is a reference to the millennium. John's scheme of things, as we'll see later on, the millennium is there primarily as a reward for the martyrs. Remember, in the first resurrection, the martyrs will be raised, Satan will be tied up, is the way John viewed it, and the martyrs with Christ will rule for 1,000 years. And then will come the second resurrection, the release of Satan once again, which I never could understand. But in other words, John's scheme of thing gives the martyr the special place where he rules with Christ for a time. The morning star is Christ himself. So that what is given to the conqueror is none other than Christ himself. White garments, symbols of victories. Name in the Book of Life, which of course means living beyond the resurrection. Confessed before Christ, before God, simply the idea that Christ is the intercessor for the conquerors and will speak in their behalf before God and the angels. 3:12, they are promised to be a pillar in the temple. And of course, you already know that in the New Jerusalem that John foresees, there is no temple. So clearly what it means is to reside always in the presence of God, never to go out, never to be taken away from the presence of God, and to carry the name of God and the city, Jerusalem, the new city of God. Finally, in 3:21, the conquerors are to sit on the throne with Christ. Another reference somewhat related to the millennium idea. Now, the reason for this, the reason for itemizing these things is because I want you to see the kind of regard that John has for the martyr and the importance of the martyr in his scheme of things. And I guess I can't say it differently than that, other than to say that again and again we will find John giving the honored place to the martyr. Any questions or observations about it?
Yes, I have been confused about this millennium, and is that like the rapture? is it taught?
We'll look at that later on. That comes up later on in John's revelation. But let me give you a quick preview, all right? Quick preview. In John's scheme of things, the course of history gets worse and worse and worse. The persecution becomes more and more intense. Until finally, Christ comes again. The Parousia. And at that time, on earth, a rule is established, a kingdom is established, and the martyrs are raised from the dead at this point to participate with Christ in that millennium. And during this time, Satan is bound, John tells us. And after 1,000 years, well, one could put it this way, Satan is unbound, released. And there is then the final struggle with Satan, and Satan is once and all defeated. And then comes the second resurrection, the general resurrection. Everybody gets into this act, you see. And here then, the new heaven and the new earth is given. So that this is a rule of Christ in this world, an earthly rule. The final new heaven and new earth is the is beyond this world, is beyond the physical world. What
John has done there, as I mentioned briefly yesterday, is to put together two different Jewish ideas of what would happen when the Messiah came. One idea was that the Messiah would be an earthly ruler, a king, and that the kingdom of God would be on this earth. It would be a physical, material king. And if you look back in the Old Testament, that's the kind of first hope, primary hope that the Jewish people had. You know, it would be a time of peace, prosperity, and all the rest. So some of the Jewish apocalyptic literature had this idea of the earthly kingdom. Others, as we suggested yesterday, had given up on this earth, on this world. There's no way this world could ever be redeemed so as to accommodate a rule of God. Therefore, this earth has to be entirely destroyed and a new one created. Well, and then in that case, the Messiah is more likely a kind of a heavenly, divine creature, not so much a physical, earthly ruler. Some Jewish apocalyptic literature even has a Messiah who reigns for a time and then dies. But the other idea is this kind of heavenly Messiah who rules in a new heaven and a new earth. And what John has done is put those two together. And part of the reason he does that is in order to give the martyrs a special place. Now, I'm sorry, I've blabbered on and on and on and on there, but this, and we'll see the place of the millennium in John's scheme more carefully toward the end of the week, but is that clear enough for the time being?
Well, there's still another little facet on then, like the thief on the cross, today thou shalt be with me in paradise. Where does he fit in that scheme?
Okay, does anybody else have any questions they want to ask? I was just joking. Hold your question. Did you want to address her question?
No.
Oh, all right. Well, I really don't quite know what to do with that, except to say that there are two kinds of life after death in the New Testament. One is the resurrection of the dead, the idea you die, you get buried, and then after you're asleep in Christ, as Paul put it, and then at a certain time, God reconstitutes you and your body and brings you to life. And Paul said, that's an immortal, imperishable body, a pneumatic body is what he called it, a spiritual body that God reconstitutes in the future. There are few places in the, and that's the primary hope for the future, life after death in the New Testament. There are few places, and you put your finger on perhaps the clearest one, where it seems as if there's a concept that the essence of the person, the person's personality, I'm trying carefully not to use the word soul because that has a lot of pack, carries a lot of weight. The essence of who I am goes directly to God upon death. That's the other concept, and it does sound like the Greek concept of the immortality of the soul. It is like that, even though the concept of soul in the first in the New Testament is not exactly what we mean by soul today, the way we throw the word around, particularly out of the Roman tradition, you know. So apparently Luke believes in some way that one upon death, today upon death, goes to be with God. Two quick things to say which kind of expresses my opinion that maybe that difference, the difference between the two positions I've made is not so important. One is that if Paul is right and this is a kind of sleep until the day of resurrection, there is no consciousness of time passage. So that the experience of the individual is death, resurrection to God immediately, you see, because there's no consciousness of time. And the other thing that kind of nullifies the distinction between there is Paul cheats a bit, you know, and he says that this new body is a spiritual body. Well, then if it's a spiritual body, how is it different from some kind of, when I say the essence of personality, who I am, goes to God? How is it different from that? It's not very different. So the different kind of, I think, is two images, two symbols for how we might speak about life beyond the grave. But now in Revelation, be there no doubt about this, in Revelation it is the resurrection of the body. He knows nothing of the immortality of the soul. He will tell us that the souls of the martyrs are hidden under the altar of God in heaven. And that's kind of like Paul saying being asleep in Christ, you see. But it's resurrection that he thinks of. Okay, let me say one more thing and then I promise I won't say anything more about this. But it's so important. One of the values of the resurrection of the body idea, and the reason that the Jews believed in it, and the reason it was the first century Jewish concept of life after death, was the fact that the Hebrews couldn't imagine a person existing without a body. You know, the whole idea of the Greek immortality of the soul was very far from their mentality, because it, for the Hebrew person in the Old Testament, you are one. You can't cut a part of you out and say, this is my soul, separable but from my body. So the Hebrews had to think of life beyond the grave in terms of resurrection of the body, the wholeness of the person, you see, being brought back together. And that's the view that the Christians inherited, and certainly the view that John emphasized. My goodness, that was simple little question and elaborate. This gentleman is promised.
As deep as that, I don't think. I was just wondering if there was any significance to the new name mentioned in 2:17 that would be occurring.
2:17. Let's see.
Dealing with the white stone that. New name written on the stone.
Yeah. Which no one knows except him who receives it. That's the identity of the martyr as martyr. It is the identity of the martyr as one who really conquers. See, because John is conscious of the fact that we're inclined to say the one who is martyred has lost. You see, the enemy has won. Another head is chopped off for the emperor. The secret identity given to the martyr is that they are really the ones who conquer, not the ones who are conquered. So I think that's what it means. It seals them, identifies them as one of God's own, and in particular, I think, the martyr. Good question. There are no questions that are simple. Let's realize that today. There are no such questions.
I have one. Who are the Nicolaitans?
Okay. You sure you want to ask that?
That was going to be easy.
Would you like to reconsider? Okay, there are three groups or persons identified in these letters who are the bad guys and gals, because Jezebel is one of them. Balaam, Jezebel, and the Nicolaitans.
How about Balaam?
Yeah, okay, related to Balaam, yeah. We don't really know exactly who these people were. We know that John accuses them of heresy, insofar as there was heresy in that day, and, you know, false teaching, and leading the church into immorality. The word Nicolaitans is a Greek word which means conqueror of the people, to conquer the people. Balaim is a Hebrew word which means the consumer of the people. So you see, they're very closely related. The best, or let's see, let me say, the view that's being propagated more and more today is that these are three Christian prophets. Oh, and incidentally, Jezebel is a prophetess, and John never questions that, if that's not the point. She's a false prophetess, but you see, there's no doubt that there were female prophets in the early Christian church. End of little message there. What was I saying? Okay, that there is one of them. Now, which one? Oh, it's Jezebel in 2:20, who has led the Christians astray by having them eat the meat that was offered to idols. And so a growing consensus today is that all three of these are persons who have led the church to make compromises between their Christian faith and pagan practices in their local community. And so that each of these three has said, for instance, it doesn't matter if you eat the meat that's been offered to idols, because idols are not real. The gods behind the idols are not real after all. And we're freed in the gospel from belief in such superstition. Therefore, we can participate in those things. So in other words, pagan religions, worship of idols, was a part of the society in these churches, the Greek Hellenistic society. And the constant temptation for the Christian was to participate, you know. I'm trying to think of a contemporary analogy, and the only one I can think of is the way that some religious sect groups feel about saying allegiance to the flag. For them, that is compromise. I don't want to get into a discussion of that, but that's compromise of one's Christian faith to the societal emphases. And so more than likely, that's what lies behind these three, and that is their fault, what they have done to the Church of God. And I think that's an important point, then, that behind these three, at least, is the whole matter of one's compromising one's faith in order to fit into society more comfortably. Now, that's the best I can really do with that, you know. And that seems to be the direction of modern scholarship when it comes to those three. Very good question. Very good question. I thought you said that was a simple question.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be.
Don't lead your brother astray.
And helping the gods to do the same, you see, and bring the fertile season once again. It's okay, we tend to call it magic. It is the idea that human action of 40, 50 years earlier, Christians who felt themselves free and liberal were eating the meat offered to idols. And you know, they didn't think that defied them at all. And Paul said, in effect, you're right, you know, there's no God behind those idols, but if eating that meat offends other Christians who are perhaps weaker and leads them astray, then you must give up your right to eat meat. And what is it, how does Paul put it then about, right at the end? Help! if eating meat will lead my brother astray.
Isn't that about a stumbling block?
Yeah, okay, stumbling block, that's right. Yeah, proved to be a stumbling block to others. So maybe that's what you're thinking. Does that sound? Oh, and you see, this is much the same question as Paul dealt with in his own day. What's interesting in Paul's point of view is that, yeah, theoretically, you know, there's nothing wrong with this. Your freedom in the gospel allows you to do that, but it has certain implications for other people.
Now, John is not quite so tolerant of that. You see, and it could be Paul's position that these three are preaching in these churches, and John must disagree with. John, on this point, is not as free and liberal as Paul was about it. Yes, sir, way back there.
Each time it also refers to sexual immorality, I wonder if that refers to co-prostitution, and that would really, that'd be a lot more than eating a little bite of meat.
Yeah, right. That's right, yeah. What we're going to throw Jezebel on her bed and something, and all those who commit adultery with her, verse 22, I'll throw her on a sick bed, and those who commit adultery with her, I will throw into great tribulation, etc., etc. Are you acquainted with the concept of cult prostitution? We can talk about it. It won't attract the bears, I think, to talk about it. Yeah, because it's daytime.